Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
This is Andrew Horowitz. You know, here's the problem. I hear people that say all the time that they feel kind of chained to their office computer, you know? They spend hours and hours stuck in traffic just to get to their office PC. I know I do it a lot. Stay in the office late at night and never really any time for friends and family. If this sounds like your life, try GoToMyPC. It lets you take your office with you wherever you are and wherever you go. So here's what you can do. You can definitely be more productive from home or anywhere. All you have to do is log on to gotomypc.com at your office desktop, and it instantly appears. Your whole office is right there in front of you. You can use any program, work on a file, check email, and access the networks of your choice. You know, anything that you have in your definite your remote folders or your defined areas that you have on your PC at the office, right from your laptop at home or wherever you are. Here's what you can do. You can try GoToMyPC free for 30 days. But you must visit gotomypc.com/podcast. That's gotomypc.com/podcast for a free 30-day trial. You'll be happy you did. Well, hello and welcome. This is Andrew Horowitz, and you are listening to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. It is episode number 104, and it is, I guess 4 weeks of the incredible market rally that turned on a dime in the beginning of March. Seemed like the end was near and the market was going to continue down. As a matter of fact, my guest at that time, right about then, had predicted, if you recall, that the S&P 500 was going to be hitting 500 very, very soon. And all of a sudden, it was almost like the waters divided and just boom, the markets heard that and got very pissed off and went the other direction pretty quickly, not only on the domestic front, but on the global front as well. So, you know, we saw the leaders in the financials really take up dramatically this week when we saw Wells Fargo pre-announce. Now, remember, that was a pre-announcement of Wells Fargo when it came to their actual earnings, saying that they're going to have a great quarter. And that's on the heels, of course, at the beginning of this, which started all this. Really, if you think about it, what started all this was Citibank. They had come out with a quote-unquote, you got to put the fingers up in quote, a secret or at least a leak. Of a letter from Vikram Pandit, the CEO of Citibank, Citigroup. I'm still stuck in the days when I called Citibank. And he had talked about how they were going to be miraculously profitable this quarter. You know, what's interesting is what I had talked about and I had mentioned, I think, several months ago was what is going to probably end up happening with these banks is that they're going to write down an incredible amount of bad debt and losses. And really have, if you think about it, nothing to base their expenses on anymore. So when you look at what's happening with these right now, they've written down most of their bad debt. The losses are pretty much non-existent. And now what they have is a pool of assets that is providing an amazing amount of return for them. Because essentially what they're saying is that the income they have or the revenue that they have right now is based on this pool of assets, which is a much smaller pool of assets because the rest of it has been written down and pretty much disappeared. So they pretty much went poof, these no longer exist in our pool of assets. And now we have these assets that are actually providing this much income. And when you look at it, you say, wow, that is doing really well. But in total, when you look at it, this is one of those weeks that you just have to scratch your head and say, what was that? It was a shortened week, of course. And there's a growing chorus of those who think it's really not that bad. And therefore, things are looking good. And plenty of opposition as well. But it is truly amazing to see the incredible level of what I would think is, I guess, best described as chicanery that is going on. And seemingly with the blessing of those up in the administration. You know, the continual rhetoric and now the well-planned pre-release of this Wells Fargo earnings number, which interestingly happened the day after. Of course, they talk about, you know, putting some new restrictions on short selling via the possibly reinstatement of the uptick rule. And that comes right on the heels, of course, of horrible earnings from companies like Mosaic and questionable earnings for the most part from the retail sector and very poor earnings and a miss by Alcoa at the beginning of the earnings season. Don't you find it interesting that we're seeing these interesting announcements right in the beginning of earnings season? I mean, we're seeing, again, Monday and Tuesday of last week, a drop-off in the markets by about 4%, which is pretty rough, of course, for a couple-day period. But then those were days without any intervention or any other government kind of stimulus or, you know, discussion of any sort. And then all of a sudden we see the drop-off from Alcoa and we see, you know, the bad numbers, which, by the way, interestingly, Alcoa popped the next day when we saw additional government stimulus and via the uptick rule possibly, and then the follow through the following day with the Wells Fargo number. But it's, again, just before a long weekend, and it's kind of almost comical. You know, these things happen on a regular basis, whether it's an amazing announcement right on the Thursday prior to options expiration, or maybe this situation where investors were going to have an opportunity to kind of think about, hey, you know what? What's going on here with these earnings that we saw? But you know what? Wash them out by some really good things that we are showing you, like the Wells Fargo numbers. Of course, it's very clear that without the discussion of stimulus and maybe a relaxation of banking or accounting rules, that the market seemed to have a really bad habit of falling off. Have you noticed that? You know, as I mentioned, you take as an example last week's early market action where we saw that 4% drop. But here's what I think is really kind of interesting, what we need to keep aware of. It appears to me that when you look at things like Walmart's numbers, which were a big disappointment last week, but then again, we see let's talk also at the good side. We saw, of course, retailers beating, Hot Topic beat, or at least didn't do as badly as anticipated. And to my horror, because we were short, the Buckle, which has a habit of doing very well of late, but shockingly thought it was very much ahead of itself. They came out with same store sales that actually looked a lot better than we thought it was going to be. But, you know, the media has been twisting what is truly an ugly dynamic of economic indicators into one that is filled with, I think, silver linings. You know, how much worse can it get, they say? And they're writing about this, stirring up the hope and the prospect for a speedy turnaround. Even Larry Summers last week, did you see this? Is now expecting a recovery as early as September. Amazing. We were dropping off a cliff until 3 weeks ago, and now all of a sudden we're going to come up with an amazing, amazing growth in just a couple of quarters. So it seems, I guess, that all the bad is baked in and good times are around the corner, right? Investors are clearly anxious to risk their capital again, as it appears that no bankruptcies are going to occur. I mean, who knows if GM is going to become a bankrupt company or it's going to be left to be one of the zombies as we have in much of the capital markets right now. But it seems that, you know, it's just not allowable or palatable by the current administration, government, or whoever you want to call it, the Congress, to allow these companies to go bankrupt, even though it's probably better for them in the long haul to restructure with a much greater ability to manage their debt. But here's what I think is going to happen, to be honest with you. Here's what I think. It seems that they're setting up very, very, in the near term, let's say, for GM to go through a government-sponsored bankruptcy. We saw just last week again the continuation of talks and work being done to move into that dynamic. But at the same time, we saw an additional bailout of, I think, upwards of $5 billion, another few billion, into the auto parts and the sector that would get hurt the most. Because, you know, when we talk about GM going bankrupt, you know, a lot of people think about, oh my God, all these loss of jobs, et cetera. But the job losses really are not necessarily only going to be with GM. They're going to spread out to the entire supply chain. That's the biggest concern when they're talking upwards of 1 million jobs would potentially be lost. But really, what they've done now is soften the blow by giving a $5 billion kickstart or a back-end payment to soften the blow if, in fact, they're going to take GM and go through the government-sponsored bankruptcy, which I think is a very possible and viable alternative, and it's going to leave pretty much just the foreign and Asian car makers primarily that are going to gobble up the American share, and then on top of that, maybe Ford. We're thinking about Ford may be one of the beneficiaries of all of this, but it does seem that banks now are on the mend, and I say that with incredible caution and almost wondering that if I really even said that out loud, okay? And stocks have gone, stock investing has really gone from, I guess it best be said, has gone from reckless to riskless in a matter of under 30 days. I mean, does a lot of this all seem kind of too good to be true for you? One of the things that we look at quite regularly is the New York Stock Exchange volume. And we track it regularly to see how things are playing out into these markets. And one of the interesting things that I have seen, if we look at a five-day moving average for volume, it is once again trailing off. It has been trailing off every single day. In other words, if you chart the five-day moving average, what you'll see is, as a matter of fact, we'll put this chart in the show notes at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. But if you chart the five-day moving average, it is at a low point again and has been falling daily since the March rally began. Most of the recent bear market rallies that we have seen have been slowing, have been showing slowing volume, constantly slowing and slowing and slowing, like there's just a lack of participation or something. And then the downturn begins and volume picks up once we see the market in decline again. It clearly indicates something is going on. And there's a very interesting correlation between the lack of volume and markets moving up. It's almost like the short sellers are just stepping aside for a little while, and then they come and just wallop investors right over the head. Now, when we add some of these concepts that we're seeing maybe, I don't want to say better than, but less ugly economic indicators, a few of them, to the current markets scenario, the VIX, the volatility measured by this Chicago Board of Options Exchange, now trading below 36 as of right now, which is just a touch higher than when it was when it opened for trading on January 1st, 2009. And the markets have really been shooting up, and it seems that relaxing a bit in the face of the fact that it's moving up. But yet, at the same time, you would think that we would have a lot of money being moved into the markets, right? Individual investors shoving money back into mutual funds, into ETFs, etc. But according to TrimTabs, the reports that we have been seeing, investment inflows are just generally anemic. And if we look at that and add to the continuing decline in the volume since the beginning of March, you have to wonder if some of the bad news twisted good news reverses. And if it does, when reality sets in throughout the earnings season and with the economic indicators that we're going to see, and when possibly, the government takes their foot off the pedal just for a moment, just to kind of see how things are, that maybe we are going to see another leg down, which would be the most plausible explanation of what we're going to see moving forward. I'm not trying to throw a cold water on this rally, but I want to realize that this move up was pretty substantial. One thing that is clearly undeniable, though, right, is the power of the rally. And the fact that we are now above the 850 technical target that we have been watching for. And, unless there is a significant change to those fundamentals, and the fact that the 20-day moving average for the S&P 500, which is just a broad-based measure that we look at, has crossed the 50, a really important note that we're seeing an uptrend, pursue, and the short-term trend is really moving nicely into the longer-term trend, that we can be a little bit more relaxed with some of our positions, but not so relaxed that we're just going to, let it just sit there and waste away. One of the things that we're looking to do is adding a different kind of hedge to our portfolios right now. Consider looking at things like options, like the S&P 500, the 790 put, for example, for May, maybe even June. Reasonably priced and actually low priced now. The market has dramatically moved higher. But at the same time, buying a few of those underlying a long position portfolios, we like the agricultures. We like the core. Even though some of the things that we're seeing right now have not been working in this part of the rally and not participating, there is no way that we can have an economic recovery without the agricultures and the base metals and basically the materials companies doing well. They have to start moving for a real recovery to occur. So as earnings season approaches and starts really picking up steam fast and furious, not only this week but in the next few weeks, I feel that the most underloved area of the market is still the commodities sector. And, again, those whole commodity area has been really beaten down pretty well. What's interesting is we did see Mosaic as an example really do well last week in the face of horrible, horrible earnings. Now, on one hand, you want to say, why in the world is that happening and why would the stock be doing well? That's a good question, by the way. But it seems that we have a lot of short covering going on right now. The same thing happened with Alcoa, as an example. But no matter who says that there is a recovery on the horizon, it seems to me very apparent that we cannot be just recklessly putting our money to work unless we see a recovery in the commodities. Short positions have been blown out across the board all over the place. I think that they're setting up for a little bit of a turn down here. And again, even though there is this general relief for investors right now, we're still 40% off the recent market highs, really only slightly above the low if you really think about it. And some stocks are up nicely this year while others are down very significantly. Your job is to look for opportunities that keep portfolios basically stable right now, right? Because the market is broken. Let me say that again. The market is broken. There are significant problems in this market. And, you know, realize that when you have a market that shoots down so low and now one that has 85% of the stocks in the S&P 500 or in the New York Stock Exchange, 85% of the stocks in the New York Stock Exchange are over their 50-day moving average. We're only about 20% a month ago were in the same position. That is one hell of a rally. And we're really getting this. Why? Is we getting this because earnings are so good? No. Are we getting this because anything has really changed? No. We're getting this because there's optimism about the opportunity to invest when the markets are being pushed and pulled by governmental intervention. There's a new set of information you really need to look at in every piece of your research, and that is to add in a bet on what the government is going to do. Will they bail out the insurance sector? Yes. Will they keep banks alive and maybe as zombies? Will the stimulus package actually work? Will they need more? How can they treat capital gains? I mean, the list goes on and on. Now we're even talking about the reinstatement of the uptick rule. You know, what is going on here is that the government, with all their firepower, is doing everything they can to break the back of this market decline when they should really be looking at a much different metric, in my opinion. I love the market going up. But we need to discern the difference between breaking the back of a market problem from an economic recovery, because so far there have been no jobs created. Well, there's been some, but clearly we're still losing a lot. Net losses in the 650,000 per reporting period. Hello? We're at 5.5 million, 8.5% overall unemployment by one metric, almost over 15 to 16% over the real metric that shows the broad-based measure of real losses. But the problem is that we have a moral hazard that's growing that just, again, is just causing reckless behavior. But the real thing that I think is that these days are very darkened by the smudges of governmental fingerprints trying to strangle capitalism. This is no longer a total capitalistic environment that we're living in, where we have so much government intervention in our capital markets. Does that make sense? That makes sense. Well, here's what I think, without me continuing going on with this whole discussion, but here's what's interesting. I was able to get a great individual to talk to about many of these topics, but particularly about the Fed. And when we get back, we're going to talk to him. He wrote a book that's called The Creature from Jekyll Island. I think you're going to find it highly, highly interesting. I've talked with him just briefly before, and he's a fascinating individual. And I think we're going to find out a lot about the Fed, where it came from, where it is now, what their real intentions are. And I think you'll really enjoy this. We'll put some of this information on the website, some of those charts we just talked about. I think that, you know, no market shoots to the moon in one direction only, nor does it go down in one direction only. We're seeing a healthy banter of both, of course, but at the same time, I think we have to get through this earnings season to really find out what's happening, even though we are much better footing right now, and we are much more positive just on where we're seeing right now. Of course, that could change in a second with us because, you know, these markets are moving that quickly. There is no general movement in one direction or the other. It's almost like an everyday event that we're seeing the ups and downs. And last thing I'll mention to you is we are also looking at something that's very interesting. And that is a new development when it comes to the block trading platforms and who's really moving this market. There's been some discussion of another black swan event coming up and the potential of why that would happen. Before I really, you know, kind of get into whether I believe that's possible or not, I'm going to do some more research on it, maybe bring on some of the people that are writing these studies. Very interesting, very, very high end. And we're going to look into it and bring that to you in the next few episodes. In the meantime, stick around. We'll be right back. We're going to bring on Mr. Griffin, who is the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island, all about the Fed. When we get back on the Disciplined Investor Podcast, stick around. We'll be right back. All right. Well, we're back on the Disciplined Investor Podcast with Edward Griffin, who is the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island, a fascinating account of the beginnings and all about the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States of America, and the Federal Reserve, we call it, now being run by our favorite Fed chief, Bernanke, who is doing quite the job to spend our money. Anyway, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it. How are you?
Well, thanks a lot, Andrew. Good to be here.
So tell me about how did the Federal Reserve, I think it started back in, 1910? How did it get started? And tell me some of the basic history of the Federal Reserve.
Yeah, I know we don't have a lot of time, and this is very interesting history. It's hard to cut it down, but the essence is very simple. The Federal Reserve System was enacted into law in 1913, but the real action began, as you said, in 1910. As you can imagine, it took a few years to get the thing up to speed and to sell it to Congress and to sell it to the American people. So the real action began in 1910, and interestingly enough, it began on a private island off the coast of Georgia called Jekyll Island. And that's the reason for the title of my book. Jekyll Island in those days was a resort. It was owned by a small group of billionaires from New York, mostly people like William Rockefeller and J.P. Morgan and their families. And it's where they went during the cold winter months. It was a very private place. They had a beautiful clubhouse, and they went there in November of 1910. The seven men went there, and they drafted what essentially became the Federal Reserve System at that very private meeting, and went to great lengths to conceal their participation. They denied that they went to the meeting for quite some time, and so forth. But the reason for all this great secrecy was because the Federal Reserve System was sold to the American people as a means of controlling the banks, the big banks. There was a hue and cry at that time for Congress to pass a law to control the banks, and so the law, it turns out, to have been written by the very bankers who were supposed to be controlled by it. And that's the reason that these guys didn't want anybody to know that they had a voice in doing it. So it was like, you know, asking the fox to build the hen house and install a security system. So that was the reason for the secrecy. But now, of course, after all these years, there are a lot of personal notes that have been published by these participants. And they've written books, and their biographers and their children have all written about it. So you can go to any well-stocked library today, and you can learn a lot of detail about what happened on Jekyll Island. And so what did happen there is that the largest banks of the nation, with strong connections to the biggest banks in Europe as well, they created a banking cartel, and they sold it to the American people as though it was a government agency, and still most people think it is, but in fact it is not. The president is allowed to appoint the chairman and the members of the national board. But that's the extent of it. Once he's done that, he and Congress and the Senate have absolutely no control over the system at all. It's all in the hands of the bankers. And frankly, the president selects the chairman of the Federal Reserve from a list that is given to him. He doesn't know these people for the most part, and they certainly don't come from his private telephone book. So it's a very interesting concept in that a cartel, which is essentially no different than a banana cartel or an oil cartel, it happens to be a banking cartel. They formed this union. They got the Congress to pass their cartel agreement into law, so now they don't have to worry about enforcing their cartel agreement anymore. They can get the government to enforce it. And the gum-chewing public thinks it's all wonderful because supposedly it was a bill to control the big bankers. And in fact, it was completely the opposite. It turned out that after all these years, we see that the largest banks in the nation really now control the government. It's just the opposite of what people thought. And that is unfolding today. You can see it in Congress. And when the banks need another couple of $1 trillion, they just go and click their fingers, and the congressmen jump and say, okay, here's your money. You know, they authorize it.
Okay, so now here's what's really fascinating. So The Federal Reserve, of course, the word federal makes you, of course, assume federal as in government, owned by the government. So you talk about that they could snap their fingers and they can get Congress to do things, et cetera, and the bankers are really the ones in charge. But the from this vantage point, it seems like they're a branch of government, right? Isn't that the whole muse, that's what they want to for us to infer. But yet at the same time, what's really fascinating is they have use of government money at an unprecedented rate without any kind of oversight.
Well, that's close to true. The truth is it's not government money. It's their money. The money of the nation is created by the Federal Reserve System, not by the government. And that's one of the interesting things. You see, the Federal Reserve, meaning the banking cartel, the banks, let's say what it is, the banks, got a monopoly from the government to produce the nation's money. And everybody thinks it's the government money, but it is not government money. It's the bank's money. And the government backs it up with the taxpayer's obligation.
Right, so there's a no-lose for them. They have a totally no-lose.
It's a no-lose situation, right, for
exactly,
the bank.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, and that was all discussed on Jekyll Island, how to pass along these inevitable losses to the taxpayer and make the taxpayer feel good about it, thinking that it was a means of protecting, you know, the nation.
So let's talk about what you wrote the book originally. I think 1974 was when you originally printed the book, right? And you've updated it since.
Well, The Creature was published in 94.
94.
The first printing was in 94.
Okay. So now you go back into a whole history and you go through all the different things that led up to the points of where we are today. And what's fascinating is it almost looks like this program that goes on, this kind of nonstop program that is, the banks will utilize funds, of course, loan funds. They'll get to the point where they may run out of funds. And when I say run out, I mean in the sense of needing further infusions from the government, et cetera. It's a kind of a program that's on autopilot that just cycles and cycles and cycles. Can you take me through some of that?
Well, yeah, it is an autopilot, mainly because the general public is not convinced that they are capable of understanding it. They think it's very complicated, and it really isn't. It appears on the surface to be, but once you penetrate all of the jargon and all the banker language and all the camouflage, it's really a simple operation. And the other reason is that they think that it's well being taken care of by their trustworthy politicians who, you know, have oversight. So why should they worry about it? So it is autopilot in a sense, but believe me, it's very much in control of the Federal Reserve Board. They watch daily, if not hourly, the trends in the markets, and they're always determining what they're going to do to adjust this and turn that knob and throw that switch. So it's not really autopilot, but as far as the public is concerned, they have absolutely no control over it.
But let's talk about what the dangers are. That's the big issue that you really uncover here. Where the issues lie, because so far we haven't really talked about that. Where do the issues lie where these are really, may I say, bad men? These are really, something's not right here.
Well, the danger lies in that we are on the same track of history that has been traveled many times before by other nations. And that track is where the government and the bankers, or any combine, is able to produce the nation's money supply and break it away from anything solid to back it. There have been short periods of history where money has been backed by gold or silver. And under those conditions, the quantity of the money cannot be arbitrarily expanded by politicians and bankers. The only way it can be expanded is by miners. And so the quantity of the money always remains constant under those conditions in relationship to the production of other goods and services. It takes effort to mine gold. It takes effort to produce shoes and so forth and build houses. And so it's effort on both sides. And the expansion of the money supply under those conditions always keeps very good pace with the expansion of all other goods and services. And so you never have inflation. The monetary unit today will buy just as much 10 or 20 or 100 years from now as it does today. But now the track of history I'm talking about is where the governments or the banks are able to decouple the money from anything like gold or silver. And now they can make it out of thin air, which is how they do it today. They just decree all that money that's being created in Congress today through the Federal Reserve System doesn't exist anywhere. They said, okay, we'll give another trillion here, another trillion there. That springs into being out of thin air. Well, the money supply then expands. faster than goods and services. And so we have this thing called inflation, which eats away at the purchasing power, and the common man loses his purchasing power. He loses the value of his savings. And at the end of that track, it's always gone this way, he loses everything. The economy collapses. And that usually ends up in some kind of total anarchy or totalitarianism of some kind or another. And that is the danger, because that is where we are headed today.
Well, one of the things that this whole thing is set up to do is essentially allow the banks to first of all, take any risks that they want at any level that they want, be fully aware that they are protected in on the back end. At the same time, essentially fleece America, because, you know, slowly by interest payments or otherwise take money in for their use and enjoyment. Is that, I mean, that I think we, right in the beginning of your book, it talks about this. And then we talk about the bailouts and the constant bailouts and how these are just always going to happen, always going to be available. And the banks are always going to be, whether they're hated or not, but in the end, they will be essentially made whole. There'll be some, you know, collateral damage.
Under the present situation, yes. Under the present situation, which is dominated by the Federal Reserve System, that is true. But it doesn't have to be that way. And that's, of course, what I'm advocating, is that we get rid of this monster, this creature from Jekyll Island, and replace it with honest banking, where money is backed by gold and silver, and where banks are allowed to fail if they don't keep their contracts. If they make bad business decisions, they should be allowed to fail, just like any other business. In my little business, if I make bad business decisions, I'm going out of business. Right. I can't go to Congress and say, hey, I made a mistake, but give me some money. Well, we've got to put banking on that same basis. And so it doesn't have to be that way.
Right. Talk to me about there's so many different things to talk about. Talk to me about the Mandrake mechanism.
Well, the Mandrake mechanism is my little name for the process by which money is created in the United States and in most of the world today. Through the Federal Reserve System and similar central banks in other countries, money is literally created out of nothing, as I mentioned before. Mm-hmm. And I named it the Mandrake mechanism after a rather little-known comic book character that was popular back in the 1940s when I was a kid. He was a magician, and he had a cape, and he could wave the cape and produce things out of nothing and then wave it again, and they would disappear. And I thought, boy, that's how they do it there at the Fed with money creation. So the Mandrake mechanism is the accounting procedure and the legal authorization to literally counterfeit money and get away with it. That's basically the shorthand explanation. Mm-hmm. When the Federal Reserve loans money to the government, it doesn't have that money. It just creates it out of thin air. And it'll create, you know, billions or trillions. It doesn't make any difference. It just writes the check or enters the credit into the computer. And the federal government now has money in its account and starts to spend that money. Well, that inflates the money supply instantly. But that's just the beginning of it, because the money that the federal government now has from the Federal Reserve System that didn't exist before, the government spends that money, and the people who get that money now take it to their local commercial banks, and they deposit it into the banking system, and now the banks take that money, and they create more money on top of that. For every $1 that's deposited into the banking system, the banks can loan an additional $9 on top of that doesn't exist anywhere.
You know, I got to tell you something. You know, what was fascinating was when... And you obviously have a much greater appreciation for this, because you know the inner workings of the inner sanctum. When Paulson went to Congress and arranged for $700 billion, however exactly got that number, or thought it was a good number, you know, kind of when you do a sale, whether you have eights or nines, you know, a sale of some sorts are $7.77, right? It doesn't look as much as eight, doesn't look as much as nine. So we got $700 billion. But what was fascinating about that was... And I honestly, unless I am really reading this wrong, I don't think Congress got the fact that as soon as he got the allowance of that money, he was basically going to put a part of that on the Fed's book and able to leverage that 10-1. Do you think that was something they knew?
Well, Congress didn't know anything. That's the bottom line. Congress was there to vote yes,
right.
And that's what I was saying earlier. Most of those congressmen, when I say most, I mean 99% of them, never read the bill. They don't understand money and banking. They don't understand how the Federal Reserve System works, and don't particularly care to. All they know is that that there was a crisis. They were told there was a crisis. They were scared out of their wits that if they didn't vote yes, the economy would collapse. It would be their fault. They'd be voted out of office. And then the rest of the world would collapse around it, and they would go down in history as bad guys. So where do I sign? Well, how do I vote yes? So that was all they were thinking about. They're easily controlled.
It seems that way. They just want to be reelected so they get
knowledge.
Their seats.
They don't particularly care to have knowledge of any of this. They just want to do what is politically expedient.
So the last couple of chapters, we talk about the doomsday mechanism, very interesting stuff, and then we talk about the pessimistic scenario and a realistic scenario. Tell me where we're going. Where are we on the path that we are on? And you know, just not the most pessimistic scenario, not the most optimistic. I mean, where are we? Because it seems to me we're in a pretty ugly place, whereas the government is controlling everything. The stock market no longer is a free market environment to actually do anything with. And we have so much money now that is being – by the way, when you wrote this book in 1994, the word billions meant something, right?
Oh, yeah. It was a big amount of money.
Now it's $5 billion. I remember the first time I ever heard of a billion-dollar write-down, I gasped. And now it's just, you know, commonplace to talk about, you know, another 30 or 40 billion. So where are we now? Where are we going? And, you know, kind of give me the short and the longer view of what do you think is going to happen?
Well, I have been amazingly accurate, I'm sorry to say, with my predictions in the book, The Creature, written in 1994, published in 1994, as you said. And I went back and reread that second to last chapter called The Pessimistic Scenario. Mm-hmm. I just did that about 3 or 4 weeks ago after all these years, and I was shocked at how accurate all of that was. And it's not because of any clairvoyance on my part or any great brilliance. It's just that, you know, if you look at a graph and you know here's the starting point and here's where we are now, and you put a ruler between those two points, and you can say, well, assuming there's no significant change in the forces at work, this line will continue going in that same direction. So trace it out. And that's all I did. And things have continued to go in the last 15 years. They continue to go as they were going. And if anything, everything is accelerating right now. So if we keep that ruler on the chart, we can tell exactly where we're going. What we've witnessed in those years is a tremendous growth of government and all sectors of life. We've witnessed a demise of the free market in all sectors, not just the stock market, but in production and industry and everywhere. And we've witnessed the loss of personal freedom, and we've witnessed a decline in public awareness of these issues and really true understanding, being educated as to how these systems work. I mean, there was a time, probably about 50 or 60 years ago, I read some of the textbooks of the period, and there was a lot of great information in there. Well, the kids aren't getting that today. It's all been deleted. So there's a lack of knowledge. All of these things have continued. So I would trace that that ruler off to the edge of the chart, and where it ends up is total government, total loss of freedom, a totalitarian system, and the kind of an environment that is totally the opposite of what Americans have been used to and had been told that we live in. And that has got to change. We've got to move that ruler. I mean, it's the worst possible consequence that anybody can imagine. They don't see it yet because they don't know where we were, and they don't have that ruler, and they're not looking at these issues. But they'll find out, I'm afraid, very soon, and there'll be rioting in the streets and all kinds of demands for reform. But the trouble is, without knowledge of what the problem is, they're going to turn to the very people, as they are now, the very people who created this mess. They're going to turn to those people and say, now, get us out of this mess. And the same people that got us into this mess are going to continue doing the same things and get us deeper into it. So that's my concern, that the people will want reform, but turn to the wrong people to get it.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, that the most fascinating part of this is that when you know, of course, it's just natural. When we're looking for help, financial help, that is, in a circumstance that we are just unable to solve, a la the banking crisis and, you know, situation we have now, it amazes me that, first of all, that our government will seemingly not allow for anything to go bankrupt, you know, within reason. I mean, this commentary last week that President Obama had with regard to General Motors, and saying that, the best thing for General Motors is to go bankrupt. The next day, turning around saying, well, we're not going to let them go bankrupt. And then, talking about spending and things. And I'm thinking, what is going on around here? The money flying around is just amazing. And it doesn't seem to be any care for the future. That's where the concern is. And when you talk about the fact that the dollar is not backed by any kind of standard at all, we've heard a lot of discussion about this inflationary environment. You're not going to see it in one day or 2 days. It's going to creep up, but then it's going to start getting pretty concerning. I mean, we're talking, what, $5 trillion that's already been thrown at this mess already.
It was already there beforehand.
Yeah.
And many more to come. That's no question about it. But yet the idea of the too big to fail is ludicrous, of course. It's the bigger they are and the more fraudulent they are, the more they deserve to fail. I think we've got to start changing slogans. I like the slogan, what we need now is a good recession. I think that's what people should be saying, a good recession to clear the garbage out of the system so we can recover. I think there's a good analogy that just popped through my mind as you were speaking. If a person has an infection, or maybe even pneumonia, let's say, a very serious infection that can take their lives, and the body reacts with a fever. Well, the fever is necessary because the increased temperature is instrumental in killing those germs. They can't live under the higher temperatures and the increased oxygen flow that comes with a fever. And so we go to the doctor, and he says, oh, well, we've got to get rid of that fever. You don't want a fever, do you? And so they give you stuff to get rid of the fever, and then you die from the infection. And I think that's what we're facing today. People, you don't want a recession, do you? We need a good recession right now to clear all of this garbage out of the system.
Right. I have one question for you in final and closing about this. Maybe a little off subject. And again, we're talking with Ed Griffin, the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island, A Second Look at the Federal Reserve. There's so much we could talk about, and I could spend hours talking. This book is just fascinating. But when it comes to the Federal Reserve, of course, we're talking about banking, we're talking about borrowing, we're talking about credit lines, et cetera. What is the fascination with this administration with issuing credit and getting the credit flowing? Because it seems to me, it relates back to the banks for a moment. One thing is they're talking about, we need to get some good refinancing to put more money in the pockets of people so they can be paying less on their mortgages. But yet, you know what? They're gonna have 5 years more tacked onto their mortgage plus closing costs. And then
It's very simple. The problem of the economy today is because we've had too much credit. Too much credit that was unwarranted, unrealistic credit. Credit based on unrealistic interest rates and so forth. It lured people into debt that they shouldn't be. The problem is we've had too much credit. And so now the politicians are saying, what we need now is more credit.
Right, exactly.
Figure it out.
I don't understand it.
Yeah. It's insane, and it leads to death of the system.
Yeah, I guess the phrase is... that comes to mind in closing is, if you've always done what you've always did, you're always going to get what you always got.
That's it, exactly.
Right?
That's where we're getting.
And then, of course, the other one is the definition of insanity, which is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. Right?
I think you just described Washington, D.C.
Hey, listen, thanks so much for spending some time with me. Again, Ed Griffin, author of The Creature from Jekyll Island, A Second Look at the Federal Reserve. And wow, something to really... marvel at. And can I make a suggestion to you?
Why, sure.
You need to get this on the Kindle over at Amazon. I'd love to. I mean, I love the book, don't get me wrong, but I just love reading this kind of stuff on the Kindle because I get to take this.
Well, I've had some people suggest that, and we're probably going to look into that very seriously.
Yeah, I think that would be.
Meanwhile, if anybody wants to get the book, they can get it from our website, which is therealityzone.com.
Okay, great. Appreciate it. We'll make sure to put that on the on our website in the show notes. And if you ever get down to Florida, look me up.
Okay, you bet.
Thanks so much. All right, have a great day. Bye-bye.
Bye. Goodbye.
Well, if that wasn't revealing, I don't know what was. That's quite some scary stuff and very it's interesting. It raises the hair on the back of my neck, to be honest with you, to kind of hear those kind of discussions and to read some of the things that he's written about and the power that they actually have at the Federal Reserve. I think there's been an ongoing controversy. Mish and I have talked about this before about who's really running the Fed, and is the Fed really independent? Are they really an official government branch? And a lot of the information is in that book. I really encourage you to pick it up. With that, we're gonna cut it to the end here. I encourage you again if you want to check out that 14-minute virtual tour of the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy. please do so. You can go right to the website and just click on it, and you can just be taken through that whole strategy. Also, pick up a copy of the book. You'll learn a lot. You'll learn about technical analysis, quantitative analysis. You learn about fundamental analysis, a lot of things that don't seem to matter too much in this particular market, I must tell you. But nonetheless, I think that something you need to have in your bag of tricks, it's really this quanta funded technical analysis style that we use to really pretty much keep us out of trouble and to keep our portfolios on the up and up through over a period of time. With that, we're going to end this. I hope you enjoyed. I hope we'll see you again soon. Again, this is Disciplined Investor, episode number 104. Thanks for listening. We'll see you real soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.